Good evening. This is Bill Downs in Washington, substituting for Eric Severide. We are approaching that time of the year when news editors sit down and choose the 10 biggest news stories of 1958. And Mr. Henry Luce's news magazine goes through the annual ritual of picking the so-called Man of the Year. It occurred to us that if Mr. Luce can have a Man of the Year, why can't everyone else? Republicans and Democrats, scientists and dolts, politicians and voters. We were kicking the idea around with some of our Washington colleagues the other day, and it was agreed that the true men of the year are seldom given proper credit, those characters in the background who initiate or embellish a story or event. A staunch Democrat present said his party should nominate Harold Stassen for the honor, but another partisan said no. The man of the year for the Democratic Party should be that Andean hunter who shot the vicuña that got to the House of Goldfine. Someone then asked, who should be the man of the year for the Republicans? Well, our GOP colleague on hand, still suffering from November's election buffeting, thought long and deep. It's obvious, he said finally, the Republican Party should make their 1958 Man of the Year honor a posthumous award to the late John D. Rockefeller for having the foresight to sire a son named Nelson, although we don't know yet just where Nelson's going to stand with the Dirksen Bridges wing of the party. Well, as such discussions will go, the talk turned to international affairs and who was really this year's unsung man of the year in the Soviet Union. The Russian who makes Khrushchev's vodka was considered and rejected, so was Mrs. Khrushchev. But this informal board finally agreed that the West really owes the man of the year honor to the Russian official who read Boris Pasternak's Dr. Zhivago. This unsung hero, by banning the book, the Nobel Prize, and attacking the author, struck a blow for freedom that rang around the world. When the informal nominations got into the field of arts and sciences, there immediately came to mind a man from Memphis, Tennessee, that unknown lover of good music, the chairman of Elvis Presley's draft board. And what explorer would not endorse for the man of the year that perceptive sailor on the nuclear submarine Nautilus who remembered to take aboard a load of ancient North Polar ice for the Admiral's cocktail parties back here in Washington. But here we got one objection from a Marine correspondent, naturally. If there's to be a military man of the year for 1958, he declared, then surely it should go to that little Lebanese boy who greeted the advanced Marine detachments which landed on the shores of Lebanon last July 15th. This Beirut youth set up a cold drink stand to slake the thirst of the U.S. fighting men. He proved the efficacy of individual ambition and free enterprise, and so overcharged the leathernecks that they had little money left to get into trouble with. A true advocate of Arab-American understanding. This truly has been an eventful year, with segregation and satellites filling the headlines, with recession and rock and roll badgering the citizenry. One man's man of the year is another man's bum. And we give fair warning to Mr. Henry Luce that if he's smart this year, he'll stick to Santa Claus.
All folks around the county used to talk about the blizzard of 1900 and the big storm of 1912. But now, young and old alike talk only about the big December blizzard of 1958. Today's break in the weather brightened the spirits of Oswegonians, but it was short-lived. The first thing you did this morning was walk around the house, looking for any cracks in the walls and ceiling. The joy turns quickly to gloom as you see families evacuated from homes, as beams begin to crack from the tremendous weight of more than 70 inches of snow. It began snowing about 1 o'clock last Sunday. It snowed hard, but no one gave it much thought. Just another snowy Sunday afternoon. Plows will soon be out. The youngsters will shovel a driveway tonight. But about dinner time, it's still snowing hard. Now the local radio station warns it's a big storm. Cars are stuck. Roads are closed. Don't go out if it's not necessary. Well, we've had storms before, you say. We'll just relax and hit the hay a little early so we can shovel in the morning. And then morning arrives, and it's still coming down. One of the youngsters rushes upstairs exclaiming that the road is filled right in. Plows never got through. Quickly, we turn once again to radio and get the bad news that our city has been turned into a snowbound area resembling something you might expect in the Swiss Alps. Schools and industries are closed. Well, we might as well start shoveling. But how do you get out? Picture, if you will, going out a second-story window and dropping into a snowbank from a porch roof in order to shovel snow away from the door so the rest of the family can get out. At first, it seems funny. And then you begin to get bored. What do? Still no school. Factories still closed. Meetings, bowling, shopping, everything postponed. Believe me, it's easy to get bored under a blanket of 6 feet of snow. Just looking at four walls or out the window at more snow. Well, it's finally stopped for a little while. Guess we'll go out and hike downtown and look things over. So you set out. Drifts 8 and 10 feet high, right in the middle of otherwise busy streets. It's just about as bad as the radio said. Finally, you get to West 1st and Bridge Street, normally the busiest corner in the city. All you see is snow. Banks in front of busy stores, or usually busy stores, some 12 and 15 feet high. One enterprising merchant dug a tunnel through an 18-foot bank to his front door, hastily made a sign and hung it on the snowbank at the entrance to his tunnel, proclaiming, of all things, a sale on bathing suits. Well, there's only one place to go. Throughout the entire storm, the only people who did a rushing business were the neighborhood taverns. Really, it was quite an experience, but one I wouldn't want to go through again. Now back to CBS News in New York.
This is George Herman, substituting for Eric Severide with news analysis. The Military Air Transport Service announced today that during the month of November, it flew Thor intermediate-range missiles and their launching equipment to Britain at record rates. The bulk of the 80 trips flown by MATS last month was, of course, taken up by the vans, trucks, and trailers packed with the equipment which is designed to fire the Thor 1,500 miles in a completely automatic process. Because Thor is a weapon system which is designed for fast retaliation. Its missiles lie out in the open, their only protection from enemy attack, their ability to get off the ground before enemy bombs or missiles land. In Britain today, another news report says British and American officials are now negotiating for the construction of a missile-detecting radar station in Scotland. And this now underlines a glaring gap in the Thor weapon system. Thor is designed to get off the ground in 15 minutes from a cold standing start. In times of world tension, it can be held indefinitely, ready to fire in 8 minutes. In supreme emergencies, it can be advanced to a point where it can be fired in just 2 minutes. But it can only be held at this advanced point for something over an hour and must then be reserviced. Russian intermediate-range missiles, accurate and located by the hundreds along the Iron Curtain, could strike our bases in something like 8 minutes. A surprise attack, even if quickly detected by radar, would allow us to fire off only those Thors ready at the 2 minute point. But for the next year at least, there will be no radar warning at all. We are only now negotiating for the first link in any radar network capable of detecting a missile attack on Western Europe and Britain. So, the first squadron of Thor missiles in Britain will be fully ready as a weapon of retaliation by next February, but the radar network to tell us when to launch those Thors will not be ready for considerably more than another year, possibly 2 years. What we must assume is that in any new Pearl Harbor type of attack, the enemy would first seek to destroy our missile bases, then our slower means of retaliation. And a free world weapons system, which has neither the protection to survive an enemy first blow, nor the means of getting warning and taking off before that blow lands, such a system cannot be considered to have much effectiveness as a weapon of retaliation. And by the same token, it cannot be considered as much of a deterrent to enemy attack. Our Thor base in Britain does have other uses in the spectrum of various possible hot and cold wars. We know that we don't intend to start any war, but we don't wish the aggressor nations of the world ever to rule out completely the possibility that if they push us too far, we might start the action. We don't want them to feel that secure. As a means of retaliation, the Thor weapon system in Britain is a two-legged stool based on a missile and a firing system. The third leg, an adequate warning system for quick retaliation, is missing. A two-legged stool has some uses. It's better than nothing, but it's not the kind of thing to make you feel secure and relaxed. This is George Herman in Washington,